countries like France, Italy and the UK have blood on their hands, continuing to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the likes of Israel, the last apartheid on earth, and Saudi Arabia, which has been ravaging Yemen for the last 7 years, pushing it to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The second day of the Iranian army's massive maneuver kicked off. This time, the ground force showed its might by deploying its artillery, choppers, and combat UAVs to take down mock enemy targets. This as the Navy also sent its homegrown Tareq and Ghadir submarines, which fired torpedoes against surface and subsurface targets in the Sea of Oman.
We in the Navy have upgraded our subsurface, surface, and aerial equipment, and this has allowed us to expand our intelligence dominance to as far as 2,500 kilometers from our coastline.
The ground force has so far accomplished all its assigned missions in the drill. We have so far acted in close coordination with the three other forces. This synergy is what we are trying to achieve to bolster our deterrence.
Codenamed Zulfaqar 1400, the massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems, held over a million square kilometer area stretching from the Strait of Hormuz to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. The military exercise seeks to upgrade Iran's capability in defending its territorial waters while sending a message to foreign actors that they're not welcome in the region.
If regional countries join hands, we can protect the security of our region, and we do not need extraterritorial actors to step in our region from thousands of kilometers away with the excuse of keeping our region safe, while in fact they bear nothing but insecurity and instability here.
In recent years, the Iranian armed forces have displayed a range of homegrown military equipment in annual maneuvers as a show of might to the country's adversaries. The military says more than 80% of the used hardware are built domestically, sending a message to the West that their arms bans have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and indigenize its defense arsenal.
Military officials say the ultimate message of this drill is that the Iranian army has the power to defend the country's soil. And what's even more significant is that it does so using entirely indigenous weapons, something which defies decades of U.S. arms embargoes that blocked Iran's access to even a bullet from outside its borders. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
There will be no trial, charges, or even a disciplinary hearing for two police officers involved in killing an 80-year-old woman inside her home with a tear gas grenade. It's the latest example of French cops hurting citizens and not facing even minor consequences. At the start of the Yellow Vest movement in 2018, police were clashing with protesters in the Mediterranean city of Marseille. Algerian national Zineb Redouane was in her fourth floor apartment trying to close her shutters when she was shot and killed. Redouane was on the phone with her daughter at the time of the incident, and she reportedly said, quote, "He targeted me. The police targeted me. I made eye contact with two policemen. One fired at me. Then they got in their car and left." End quote. She died the next day from her injuries.
Et aujourd'hui,
we have suffered repression, which no president has ever permitted in the history of this country. We are not at war. We are not enemies. But the government has waged war against us simply because we oppose their decisions. Just for that, many have paid dearly.
For months, the Interior Minister falsely claimed that the death had nothing to do with the grenade and that she died of cardiac arrest. Half of Redouane's face was collapsed in by the grenade, and she inhaled large amounts of tear gas.
On a subi une répression.
The government has not given one word of apology or one moment of compassion towards any victims of police brutality during the Yellow Vest era. Also, there has not been one word of condemnation for the police who have committed these acts. None of the police have been convicted, even though people have been blinded, crippled, and lost. Of course, our heart goes out to the grieving family, and the Yellow Vest will continue to remember Zainab Redouane and to demand justice.
Her family has sued the Interior Minister and other senior officials for concealing and interfering with evidence. A ballistics investigation by the NGO Disclose suggested that police fired directly at Redouane's window. Many wonder if there might have been some admission of wrongdoing if the victim wasn't Arab. That appears likely, but she also joins a Yellow Vest-related casualty list, which includes 5,000 people seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 other deaths. Amin Mazahari, Paris.
Meet Miqdad Kawasmeh, a Palestinian prisoner held in an Israeli jail without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. He's among the six inmates who went on hunger strike in protest of their indefinite imprisonment weeks ago. Sunday marked the 109th day since he last ate. Israeli medics forcibly injected him with nutrients on the 92nd day of its strike. Other hunger strikers are Kayat Al-Fasfus, Ala Arraj, Hisham Abu Hawash, Ayad Huraimi, and Luay Al-Ashkar. The hunger strikers, particularly Fasfus and Kawasmeh, are grappling with deteriorating health conditions, with Palestinian officials warning that the inmates are at immediate risk of death. On Sunday, over 4,500 Palestinians in different Israeli jails also rejected their meals in solidarity with the six hunger strikers. Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have held sit-ins and demonstrations over the past weeks demanding their immediate release. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has expressed grave concern over the lives of the prisoners. The UN body also criticized Israel's administrative detention practice, calling it a violation of international law. But no word or action is coming from Israel's powerful and influential Western allies. Experts believe the striking similarities they see with Israel to be the reason.
There is a tremendous imbalance of power in the world, and just as we see the tremendous crimes carried out by Western imperialist powers, the ongoing use of illegal sanctions, unilateral coercive measures to starve countries, invasions and occupations, the unstinting support, funding, and collaboration with the Zionist occupation of Palestine is part and parcel of those crimes.
Palestinian inmates regularly stage hunger strikes in protest at their illegal detention and harsh conditions in Israeli jails. What they're fighting for are their most basic and fundamental rights.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the U.S. in May 2018 unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The U.S. and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the UK, France, and Germany, known as the P4 plus 1 group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4 plus 1 start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran
seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the U.S. return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The U.S. has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the US and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, al-Houthi said, "The arms sales once again proved that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen."
America. The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with U.S. aid logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war on Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missiles sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons. So the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these Senate arse and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group donned masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
As you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners. You have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, their criminality. We're not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003 and has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Purizza, London.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden was once touted as the new Franklin D. Roosevelt. That ambition is fast dying, as are Democrats' hopes of remaining in power. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Samuel Moyne, a professor of law and history at Yale and the author of Not Enough, Human Rights in an Unequal World, titled If U.S. Democrats Return to Centrism, They Are Doomed to Lose Against Trump. Please stay tuned. U.S. Congress passage on Friday, November 5th of Joe Biden's infrastructure bill would ordinarily have been a cause for celebration, but there is a good chance it was the beginning of the end of his presidency. After all, the bill's final days marked a new consensus around a centrist set of economic remedies chosen out of fears of what will supposedly happen when progressives with a transformative agenda exercise too much influence on the Democratic Party agenda. Only 10 months ago, Biden came into office with great expectations, but greater terrors. Even more apparent at the start than now, Biden's presidency has been defined by fear rather than hope. With the assault on the Capitol earlier in the month, the culmination of a four-year death watch for American democracy, the emergency could hardly evaporate overnight. With Donald Trump temporarily ousted, his replacement also drew 1930s comparisons. The question is, he or she isn't he? Had been asked of Biden's predecessor for 4 years. To redeem the country from the fascist, was Biden going to be Franklin Roosevelt? Like FDR, Biden led Democrats who have claimed economic transformation for the sake of the poor and vulnerable, but also for the angry and disaffected voters of the stagnating middle. But unlike Roosevelt, Biden's coalition is fragile, and fissures emerged to threaten his success almost from the start. Fissures that broke it apart definitively recently, even in the midst of Biden's infrastructure victory. Other causes were forced to the margins along the way. Biden subordinated even critical fixes to American democracy, like reforms of courts and elections, to the economic agenda. As for his immigration policies, which mostly resembled the disgusting ones of prior presidents, they were treated with a partisan silence, provoking rage among the principled enough to demand fewer cruelties and restrictions, no matter who is imposing them. But Biden got a pass because enough agreed with the priority to address the economic reasons. Yet in comparison to Roosevelt's first 100 days, which saw 15 major bills and gave the early phase of every presidency its name, Biden's first 100 days were bogged down. A COVID-19 relief and stimulus bill was passed, adding $1.9 trillion in emergency spending to the $2.2 trillion of the first such bill signed by Trump in March 2020. But the real hopes fell on the big-ticket measures for infrastructure and welfare that Biden resolved to purchase separately. After all, the American Rescue Plan was only meant to be a temporary stopgap for an American society beset with deeper ills even beyond those that the virus laid bare. The game was on. At first, the debate seemed to be about how costly to make the bills and how to fund them. This was especially true for the American Families Plan, which was supposed to take steps towards an American welfare state, including by making relief measures for children in earlier bills permanent. Progressives in Congress, understanding the risks, were lauded for an early victory in August, refusing to back the first narrower infrastructure bill if Democrats abandoned the second more ambitious social spending bill. Centrists tried to tag progressives as the obstructionist. But the mainstream narrative remained that by holding infrastructure hostage, progressives were keeping centrists from returning to form. Even as it became clearer and clearer that the Democratic centrist senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and like-minded Democratic colleagues in the House of Representatives were doing damage to the ambition of the bills, a breakthrough after generations of Democratic austerity and neoliberalism still seemed possible. Then came the critical events that allowed for the centrist breakthrough recently. The election for Virginia governor last Tuesday, November 2nd. In an electoral shock, Republican Glenn Youngkin won, and more important, Griswold and uncharismatic Democratic Party sage Terry McAfee, who had once held the governor's office, lost. Even though McAfee's reputation for decades has been one of the centrists on economics, he served as Bill Clinton's campaign chair in the 1990s. Centrists scored a narrative victory. Wasn't it because of progressive excess that voters were turning on a party? Wokeness derails the Democrats, one headline ran. Lawmakers in Washington scurried to marginalize progressives by passing the infrastructure bill, with some progressive voting no, and others citing promises that Democrats will still continue on to the welfare measures. The rush to adjustment was peculiar. It is not until 2022 that the Democrats will need to show something for themselves. And there was no reason to abandon the social spending plan. However, suddenly progressives holding tough, since some Republicans supported the infrastructure plan, were dispensable. The new narrative was that Youngkin won because of anti-racist rhetoric many Democrats have adopted, along with elites branded as out of touch by other elite commentators. Centrists saw a golden opportunity to call for a return of their moderation, including in containing spending. In an extraordinary op-ed, the New York Times called for an honest conversation about abandoning progressive goals across the board, including the economy, where Americans demand bipartisan solutions that respect inflationary risks and refuse to spend very much. The truth was that Americans had gotten bipartisan neoliberalism for decades, but no matter. One Twitter commentator noted that it was hardly surprising that the lessons from Tuesday, November 2nd election matched the ideological goals neoliberal elites had before the election and decades before that. What are the odds? Democrats blew by the possibility that McAfee's failures were mainly his fault and due less to critical race theory that allegedly was already reshaping public education than to an abandonment of parents forced to endure school closures of years, itself an economic issue. Either way, the critical error is assuming that voters rejected progressive economic policies which are popular across the board. Even before the events the other day, Democrats defined what was in Build Back Better, their slogan and the name of the welfare bill downward. Free college was stripped out early, family and medical leave, standard across industrialized democracies for decades were killed late, and Biden kowtowed to centrists who demanded a more marketized version, not just of environmental concern, but of funding government across the board, as taxes hikes were reversed. With its fate no longer hostage to infrastructure, in spite of written promises from some centrists that progressives reportedly exacted at last minute, there is no reason to be optimistic about the final bill's fate. An infrastructure bill for a country in decay and decline was much needed and has itself eluded Democrats for decades. Though cut in half to win acceptance, it's $1 trillion for a garbage bag of spending, much focused on transport, is nothing to trivialize. But rarely in history has a greater looming defeat been snatched from the jaws of a political victory as the other day. In the first year of Biden's presidency, Democrats agreed that the only alternative to barbarism is, if not socialism, some modicum of economic change. Many agreed that opening acts of Barack Obama's administration had been faithfully insufficient. Now, despite the lessons of the Obama presidency, Republicans are set to recapture one House of Congress after 2 years, or both. By contrast, FDR gained seats in both houses after delivering substantive change and won the presidency 3 more times. Of course, if progressives were to secure a welfare package and retain influence in their party, Trump or an even more popular Republican could still win the presidency. But this outcome is a near certainty if the Democrats return to centrist form, as seems the likeliest outcome now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
In the space of 1 month, Iraq has witnessed at least three major events. First, an election that was mired with accusations of irregularities. Then came regular peaceful protests against the results of that election. Those demonstrations were held by supporters of not one, but several political factions. But those protests turned deadly when unidentified gunmen opened fire on the demonstrators, leading to mass casualties. And then, an attempt to assassinate the Prime Minister, Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The attacks have been condemned by all Iraqi parties, irrespective of their political affiliations. They are calling for calm, urging that those behind the killing of protesters and the attack on the PM must face justice. But some countries were quick to point fingers, even before the findings of government-led investigations are released. In this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to discuss these sensitive times for Iraq with journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnea. Mr. Magnea, welcome. What are your, in your opinion, what are the recent major developments in Iraq that you think stand out, and what do these developments mean for the country?
Thank you for having me. I think the situation in Iraq is extremely sensitive now. The recent development gave a result that some political parties were expected to win, and they've got a very large number of seats at the parliament, and other have got less seats than they have expected. And also the many candidates have requested a recount, and this is what the government is doing now. And I think the recount has finished at the moment, but what is happening is more important is the clash that has been triggered by the Americans at the time of Prime Minister, the former Prime Minister, Adel Abdel Mahdi, when they pushed people and NGOs and what they are called the Tishrini to the street to protest against the government, and they managed to overthrow the government and impose new elections. And I think that's one thing.
Elijah, pardon me, that was something we hadn't seen in Iraq before, had we? In the south of Iraq,
absolutely.
in the southern provinces. And it came after the call for the U.S. expulsion, the military expulsion of U.S. forces from Iraq.
Yes, there are many factors. First was the agreement that was signed by former Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi with China. And second, the request of the Prime Minister from the Parliament to approve the full withdrawal of all foreign forces. And I think this is when the Americans went wild and pushed Adel Abdel Mahdi out. And I think the assassination of Brigadier Commander Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi commander, both commanders that were killed by the Americans in January 2020, Abu Mahdi Mohandes, was to create instability in the country when Iran was playing a role of bringing all the parties, Kurd, Sunni, and Shia, together to be able to select the prime minister. And I think the Americans knew what they were doing by looking forward for an instability in Iraq and create an inter-Shia clashes by pushing all these people in the street and under different claim of rebuilding the country, of the lack of infrastructure, the lack of job opportunities. They tried to change the course of the event in the country, and they want to change the ideology that the country was moving forward to be independent, particularly after the defeat of ISIS.
Right.
And I
go ahead.
I think what is important is that Iraq has managed to defeat ISIS with mainly support of Iran, to the Kurds first, to the Sunni, to the Shia, to the Christian of Iraq. And I think Iraq now is capable of defending itself and is not in need of any foreign forces under the title of U.S. forces or NATO, which is exactly the same.
Okay, so those protests were legitimate at the beginning. Let's touch on that insecurity that you speak about, Mr. Magnier. I mean, the attacks on the protesters, the assassination of the Iraqi Prime Minister just recently, who will benefit from an insecure and unstable Iraq, which, let's not forget, is very rich in resources, especially with its oil wealth?
Well, we saw when General Ismail Kahani came to Baghdad, to the request of the Prime Minister, Mustafa Kazemi, is to bring stability to the country and to make sure that Iran can support Iraq, because this is what the Iraqis have always asked. So the narrative in the West, particularly among the decision makers and analysts who lack of understanding in Iraq, believe that Iran is in control of Iraq and Iran dictates who is the prime minister in the country and that Iran formed the government, which is absolutely false, because what Iran does is bring the parties together to their request and help them to select their candidate and make sure that this candidate is the one they have selected. And what's happening now, the assassination attempt against Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi, is yet another way to destabilize the country and to blame the groups that are they have the ideology to fight against ISIS and are so called that pro-Iranian. In fact, they are Iraqis with an ideology to fight ISIS, who are asking the full withdrawal of all the foreign forces, and they want to implement the request and the resolution of the Iraqi parliament to assure a total withdrawal of all foreign forces. And that doesn't suit the Americans, who promise to end all combat forces presence in Iraq by the end of this year. So now we see a month and a half or a couple of months before the date that was agreed for the total withdrawal, we see clashes in the street, we see demonstration, we see attempt to assassinate the prime minister, and we see the Pentagon going out and accusing Iran of destabilizing the country, when the role of Iran is completely the opposite. And this is what Kahani did in Iraq in the last couple of days, when he brought all the groups together and expressed the support of Iran to the Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazemi and to any Prime Minister that the Iraqi groups would choose afterward, when the result of the parliamentary election will be officially announced.
Okay, let me just expand on that a little further, if I may. Elijah, you raise Iran. Let's touch on Iran. And Tehran has repeatedly called for stability in Iraq and unity among Iraqi people of all faiths and ethnic backgrounds. And in a recent trip, as you say, to Baghdad, the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard's Quds Force, the Brigadier General Ismail Qa'ani, rejected foreign interference in Iraq's internal affairs and called for unity and stability in Iraq. How do you assess Iran's strategic view towards Iraq?
What the Americans fail to understand is the relationship between Iraq and Iran is very robust, because there is the pilgrimage between the two countries, there is a commerce, there is the electricity that Iran is providing to Iraq, and there are families that live on both sides of the borders. So the relationship is quite solid. What Iran is doing, the main concern of Iran is first to make sure that Iraq is not going to be used as a theater that is threatening the Iranian national security. And that is exactly the request of Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, who have borders with Iraq. So nothing unusual, really. Secondly, Iran's main concern is to see in Iraq a good stability and a solid government that is able to run the country, because failure to run the country, that will create instability and will allow ISIS to grow again. And third is the withdrawal of the U.S. forces. That is a request that has been formulated by the Iraqi parliament and a decision made in January 2020 when the government requested from the parliament an approval to agree on the withdrawal of the forces, of the all foreign forces, and the parliament acknowledged that and agreed with the resolution. Therefore, it is the concern of Iran to see Iraq without foreign forces that can create havoc in the country, which they are doing that, and that can export the havoc to Iran and to neighboring countries. Now, Iraq needs to stand on its own feet. Iran can only support it and can help it to stand on its own feet, but can't do the job on behalf of the Iraqis. And the Iraqis need to increase their awareness and to understand that the role of the Americans is to stay in the country, not to leave Iraq, for it's important because of the oil, the wealth, and the geostrategic position. Also because Iraq can play an important role in the region by bringing, perhaps mediating between Iran and Saudi Arabia, or Iran and other country, or Jordan or Egypt, as we have seen the summit that happened in Baghdad. So all this is creating a serious concern to the Americans, who want to remain in the country. So what they do is they push mainly the majority Shia against each other, and today we see the Sadrist movement run by Sayyid Muqtada Sadr and the other groups who are just fighting not only on social media and on the media in general, but also in the street, and the animosity between both sides is growing, and the Iraqis are failing to see the strategic objective of creating these differences among the Shia, and who is the main beneficial from an inter-Shia struggle, which is the United States and its forces, with the aim to remain in Iraq.
What about that, Elijah? What about that social media campaign? There are accusations by Iraqi officials that the United States, the embassy, one of the largest buildings in the world, the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, is playing a sinister role using social media to essentially cause what you're doing, what you're saying, sedition between the Shia. And some have even called, I've heard from officials, Iraqi officials, have called for the shutdown of Facebook, for example. Everyone in Iraq uses Facebook, and the disinformation that's on Facebook, according to Iraqi officials, is one of the reasons that's causing the unrest.
Well, this is the role of the embassy. So whenever you need to destabilize a country, you need a U.S. embassy. And this is what we've been asking for at the time of Donald Trump, for the Americans to open a U.S. embassy in Washington to remove Donald Trump. That's the role of the U.S. embassy. Now, the problem is not the role of the U.S. embassy. The problem is the awareness of the Iraqis, who need to understand how other forces who do not want the stability of the country are playing with this feeling between them and fueling this side and the other side. And the main attention today, and that's the most dangerous part, is concentrated on the Shia, because they represent 65 to 70% of the country, and because the Shia have the prime ministership, and that is the most senior and powerful position in the country. So what the Americans are trying to do is to weaken the Iraqi government, to show that the Iraqi government cannot run itself and the population is divided, so they can justify the continuous presence. And on the other hand, we see also ISIS that is growing its attacks in different parts of Iraq, and that's also an excuse that the U.S. used to use to justify its presence under the title of combating terrorism, relying on the UN resolution that allows us to go anywhere in the world under this title to occupy countries like it is doing in Syria today. So the increased awareness of the Iraqis is the main important. The Iraqi population has a role, an obligation, and a duty to be sensitive to what's happening and to go and look beyond the Facebook and Twitter and the Clubhouse and look really what the other forces are preparing for them and how they want them to fight one another. That is the most important, and I think this is also the duty of Iran to raise this topic and to make sure that the Iraqis who are just living nearby, and they have a very strong relation between the Iranian and the Iraqis, are aware what's happening in their country. And I think this is what the General Ismail Kahani did during his recent visit when he met with all forces, and he said, we agree on everything you agree. And he said to Prime Minister Kazemi, we support you in anything you are doing or whatever decision you want to make. And he went to all political parties and said, you have to agree among yourself. We can only help you if you want us to help, but you need to create a stability among you and to calm down this animosity, to construct the country and to go toward the elections and select the new prime minister.
Okay, let me go back to just an earlier point that you raised, Elijah, and it's regarding the U.S. presence. There's been calls for the withdrawal of the American military presence from Iraq, yet America, the United States, Washington, maintains its military presence on Iraqi soil. There are U.S. troops on Iraqi soil, despite the parliament and the people and the prime minister, the former prime minister, Adel Abdel Mehdi, calling for their removal. And this occupation that is now been an occupation, American occupation, has given birth to a resistance. How do you evaluate the role of the resistance in Iraq? I mean, in the absence of, some would say, an Iraqi army at the time of Daesh, it was the resistance that preserved Iraq's sovereignty. Maybe to be more precise, it was an absence of a U.S.-trained Iraqi army.
This is a very good question. So the main problem comes from Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi, who was not clear about the deal that he struck with President Joe Biden. During his visit to Washington a few months ago, Prime Minister Kazemi said in presence of President Biden that all combat forces will leave the country. Now, this is very vague because the parliament said all forces should leave and they should leave. When the Americans remain in the country, then the resistance forces are a legitimate force that is the right given by the United Nations of every single population to resist any form of occupation to their country. Now, in 2014, we have seen the training of the U.S. Army that started from 2003 to 2011. And on the first exam, the Iraqi army ran away from ISIS in Basra, and ISIS managed to occupy a third of the country. So we understand that the training of the Americans is really very shallow and should not be taken into consideration, particularly when we saw the result also in Afghanistan after 20 years of training and the collapse of the army in just 24 hours. This is when ISIS needed another ideological force, that is Hashd al-Shaabi was created through the fatwa of the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani, the fatwa al-Kifai, and this is when a new force, ideological force, was created to face another ideological force, that is ISIS. And with the difference between both is one wants to destroy Iraq, that is ISIS, and one wants to keep the unity of Iraq, and that is the Iraqis, even if when the Americans were calling for the partition of Iraq. So this ideological force is the balancing point of Iraq. This ideological force, many attempts were made by the Americans. In the media, we saw how the Western media was furious against Hashd al-Shaabi and just want any prime minister to dismantle it. This can't happen because there is a decision by the parliament to join the Hashd al-Shaabi to the security forces, and today they are well established under the command of the prime minister. Now, on the side of the Hashd al-Shaabi, there are other groups who are forming the resistance against the U.S. forces and are reminding the U.S. forces that Iraq is not a place where they can stay and that Iraq will not tolerate another occupation and they should leave. And these attacks are kind of messages that are soft messages from time to time. They send a drone, they stop a logistic support to the Americans to make sure that the Americans always remember that they should leave Iraq. Now, if the government of Iraq is not capable of asking the American forces to leave, that will give the legitimacy to the resistance forces to continue to be armed and to attack the occupation forces, because these will become an occupation force and should leave by all means, including the means of force.
Okay, Elijah, in the 1 minute that we have left, considering the current circumstances, what are the, in your opinion, the dangers and the plots that threaten the future of this country?
I think Iraq is facing is a split among its population. It's an Iraqi fight and animosity. This should end, and I think there is a strong need for everybody to be aware what's happening and for all groups to stop fighting for the seat in the parliament and to unite their forces to bring out the U.S. forces from Iraq and to reconstruct the country that is much needed to be reconstructed: infrastructure, health, transport, electricity, etc.
Elijah, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts. Elijah Magania, the journalist and political analyst, joining us. And that brings an end to another edition of The Spotlight.